We open up the second hour, as we do each Tuesday, by welcoming in our friend, writer Colin Fleming, whose latest book, available wherever fine books are sold, is If You Brackets, Fabula, Fantasy, Effery, Hope. Colin Fleming joins us on the telephone. Hello, Colin.
Hey, what's up, Kimball?
Well, just getting great weather. And I know you're a guy who doesn't mind. You like the cold. You don't mind a cloudy, rainy day. Are you bothered when it's sunny and warm this early in the year?
Yeah, I'm really bothered. Yep. I hate it. I absolutely hate it. I get sad. It was like 2 or 3 weeks ago, there was like what may have been snow falling down. I lamented that it was the last of it. I hate it, Kimball. I hate the sun. I'll say it. I hate the sun.
Wow.
Yeah, I will. I'll go there. I don't like hockey games starting when the sun's out. Before I was talking to you and did this other interview thing, I was talking to my mom. She's like, I had to get a thermostat. Like, for the air conditioner, it's so hot here. I'm thinking, well, that's going to suck. I'm not looking forward to this at all. I like to take my shirt off on the stairs when it's 20 degrees and test my toughness and let out a mighty Zulu yell. It just makes me want to go back out.
All right. Well, I'm with you on a lot of that. I don't like the heat or the humidity. If you give me a choice between 90 and 20, and I'll take the 20 every time. But I do like the sunshine. I enjoy that. But I'll take the rain. I'll take most of it.
I also live in like a sort of solitary confinement box, like the thing that they stick Stephen McQueen in at the end of. So, like, if I lived in like a nice house with like air currents and everything, I might soften my sun-based animus. But I don't know. It's like when the Bruins get going tonight. I know a guy like you, it's like you probably like texted your wife and you're like, iron my Bruins onesie, and you don't mind like when you pull like the legs and little footy bottoms, that like the sun's still out, but that just bothers me, man. It messes me up.
I understand that. I do indeed. Well, let's see. What to talk about? Well, you mentioned them. Let's talk about the Bruins for a moment. They seem to have righted the ship a little bit in these last couple games. Can they do it on the road?
Need the Bruins and the Celtics to keep winning so I don't have to focus on the most miserable, wretched Red Sox team of my lifetime.
Awful.
Who are 12 games out in the loss column a month into the season. I'm sure that someone can prove me wrong, maybe, but I would wager that's never happened. And the Bruins, I saw that Charlie McAvoy was held back. He wasn't making the trip. That's kind of a big ask to go on the road and win without him. But I also look at it this way. Like, you're really not expected to win this game. You have the game back in Boston. One thing that's going to be important tonight, and it's not a very sexy detail, is last change. Last change matters, and I've watched Bergeron kind of be handled by Aho in Carolina. In Boston, they were hiding him from Aho with the last change. So he's going to have to go against this guy and at least hold his own. But I didn't expect them. Someone posted on my Twitter, they're like, well, sometimes a team is just a level or two better than your team. And it's like, yeah, it looks that way. But Kimball, as you always say to me when you're in your cups, but you're still trying to encourage me to keep going, that's why they dropped the puck in the game.
let's go from the Bruins to a hockey question that you posed to me. I've been thinking about it for several days now. Who are the hockey players who were asked to do the most for their team, to carry the greatest weight for a team? And I don't know. I keep coming back to goaltenders.
There's one answer, Kimball. There's one correct answer. We can talk about other people, but there's one correct answer.
Oh, I'm sure there is. Now, the first name that came to my mind was Tim Thomas back in that last Bruins Stanley Cup run. Am I wrong that it's a lot of goalies on this list?
Yeah, I guess I wasn't I guess I was thinking more in terms of skaters, but okay, if we could just sort of like, we could do the goalies quickly. Tim Thomas would be a good example. Bernie Parent, those Flyers teams.
Dominic Hasek.
Oh, yeah, because he was on some, like, offensively challenged Buffalo Sabres teams when, like, the best player was, like, Miroslav Satan. And so I was sort of thinking in terms of, like, skaters because, and we should be clear that most counted upon doesn't mean, like, best ever. not the same thing.
No.
So talking about like those Flyers teams with Bernie Perron, just to give an example. Yes, they wouldn't have won without him, but you also have Bobby Clark. You can debate whether like Bill Barber should be in the Hall of Fame, but he's in, and all of these different things. They certainly have an attitude. And in one of those years, by the way, Dave Schultz, this will blow your mind, tied for fourth in the NHL in hat tricks. He was tied with Phil Esposito in 73-74. Wow. Isn't that weird? But I think the answer, the most counted upon, unfairly counted upon guy in the history of the NHL for a team was the 1980s Ray Bourque.
Oh, okay. Yep.
Because they're like, play half the game, good sir. Don't come off the ice often. Be out there for everything, even strength, power play, penalty kill. Be our main guy. Be our defensive anchor. And would you mind carrying the scoring, too, from the defensive position? That's a big ask of a guy, right? Because, like, the Bruins with Bobby Orr, well, they still had Phil Esposito. They still had Johnny Busick and everyone. But you look at, like, the 87 Bruins, and they're going to the Cup. You have helmeted Rick Middleton on that team. He looks so weird. But, like, you, like Linsman. And sort of, Neely's there, and he's popping 37 goals or whatever it was. But, okay, Bourque is the leading scorer. He's the main defensive guy. I really, like, take Gretzky off the mid-'80s Oilers. Well, they're obviously still pretty good. When those guys weren't as good and were further depleted and there was no Paul Coffey, they beat those Ray Bourque Bruins in 1990. So they still would have had a couple cups without Gretzky. That's sort of like a weird thing to say. But I don't think anyone has ever counted on a player like the Bruins counted on Ray Bourque. And they also were cheaping out, and he helped them with that.
I was trying to remember who else was playing alongside Stan Mikita back in the day, but I'm not quite old enough to remember.
Well, Stan Mikita, that's the thing with those Blackhawks teams, because Bobby Hull was there for a lot of that time. Mm. And Bobby Hull, I mean, a lot of people want to put Bobby Hull as the fifth best player of all time. I wouldn't, but he's like 10 to 12. He's somewhere in that area. And you had Glenn Hall, the goalie. I feel like the knock on that Blackhawks team is they win the cup, the one cup in like 1961, but they're a little bit like the 1989 Calgary Flames, where they were just laced with great players, future Hall of Famers, and guys who should be Hall of Famers like Theo Fleury. And they get the one cup out of it. And they were kind of fortunate to have gotten that cup, that Flames team, because they're playing a very good Canadiens team. So, yeah, he was surrounded. And then later you get like Phil Esposito and stuff, too, in that team before he was with the Bruins. So I really just, it's strange because you're sort of taking advantage of a player with the whole Ray Bourque thing. And it's like I said, that they were just, they felt at least, and I'm sure there was some reality to the perception, notoriously cheap at the time. And I love those old Bruins teams because there were just so many guys I dug, and Keith Crowder, and I like players like that, but Keith Crowder was no Yari Curry, you know what I mean?
See, I think of Mikita because when I was a little kid, I had this, I don't remember who made it, a little tabletop hockey game where instead of a puck, it was a marble, but it was the most awesome game in the world when I was about, I don't know, 8 or 9 years old, and the two teams were the Blackhawks and I think the St. Louis Blues, maybe. And it was just awesome.
Oh, so it was post-expansion, I was going to say.
Yeah, maybe. Blackhawks. No, I think it was the Canadiens. That's right, because it wouldn't have been. It was pre-expansion. So I think it was Montreal.
Yes, and that's funny because I had the game like in the 80s where it was the little puck. And it just seemed like there were like no other were video games, but it seemed so realistic. Like you really were Mike Bossy sniping and like a little sticker on him and everything. And the puck would go into the corner and it just would be but trapped in this liminal space for all time until finally somebody reached in and sort of tossed it back out towards center ice.
Exactly. We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Danton. We'll come back to sports later on and talk about a Red Sox team, a sadly forgotten team from about 40 years ago. But first, let's discuss your piece, Jazz Times, on Dexter Gordon and his work in the 80s film Round Midnight, which gave it a bit of truth that you don't always find in jazz films or music-related films, for that matter.
Well, a lot of these great, I don't want to say early jazz musicians, but a lot of these post-mid-century American jazz musicians Bud Powell is another example, Dexter Gordon in this case, Eric Dolphy, would go to Europe and would just be beloved. They would find themselves appreciated. I mean, not like they were vilified here, but it was almost like if you were a heavy metal band back in the day and you went to Japan, like to play the Budokan, people loved you. You didn't have to be that good. You could be like Cheap Trick. Like, people were into you. So these guys would go over there and they'd love it. And they'd go to, a lot of times, it was almost like F. Scott Fitzgerald going to France, going to Paris. And so Dexter Gordon did that somewhat later than some of them, like in the 1970s. And we have this film from 1986. And there aren't a lot of examples of this sort of thing where someone who's not really an actor not just acts, but they play like a version of themselves. I don't know if you've ever seen. Have you ever seen the Jackie Robinson story with Jackie
with
Robinson?
Jackie Robinson and was it Ruby Dee? I think is his wife.
Like it's odd because can you imagine what the director's saying to him? It's like, okay, Jackie Robinson, you're dealing with racism in this scene. Be upset. So like you're flashing back to these horrible experiences you had. And like channeling that into your non-professional actor performance, and they sort of just like want you because you're going to increase the gate because it's actually Jackie Robinson. So this doesn't quite work that way because Dexter Gordon, I don't want to say like it's a great like thespian performance, but I think it's pretty believable to what you would have encountered if you saw him at this time in those clubs away from home. And he's doing what he's doing for one simple reason. And he's doing it for, I shouldn't just say the music, he's doing it to challenge himself. And I identify with that a lot because like, I'm like a sort of Jack Russell in a way. Like, do you know that Jack Russell is the most abandoned dog breed in the country, at least? I don't know about the world, but it's because the Jack Russell always needs to be challenged. So if you don't challenge a Jack Russell mentally, they're going to hide your keys and then see if they can find them the next day because that's something they have to do to stay sharp. So that's one of the themes of this film, of constantly challenging yourself. And for the Dexter Gordon character, he's reached a point where the only thing that does challenge him in life, and that's what makes his life so hard in some ways, so wonderful in other ways, is creating something new in his music. And that's a kind of purpose that I think is just utterly foreign to most people and how they live their lives. But it's sort of like the soul and the engine of this film.
And now, do you think it's a good film?
I write about things in a way that if you were to perhaps check out that thing, you might find that it's whatever would be sort of the way I would put it. Because my focus when I write something isn't on that thing. I'm not a messenger. I'm not a go-between. I'm not a press agent. I'm, in my mind, I'm creating the show, the work of art. It's the same thing like when we talk about stories ever in. Those characters in and of themselves are not like geniuses or whatnot. I mean, they can be. It depends. But oftentimes, they're people of varying levels of intelligence faced with a situation or a history in their lives. So I look at nonfiction the same exact way. And that's one of the ways I'm able to go from one thing to another. But I feel like a lot of times if someone read something I wrote that was nonfiction, I make it sound a certain way that it might not in actuality be. I'm not lying to you, but my interest is in my ideas and how I'm going to render those ideas. But it's a serviceable film. And I don't think that I said anything outrightly false in this particular feature. But I also realize at the same time that when you write the work of art, a lot of times people aren't going to check out this other thing. It's one thing that always bothered me about the Sam Cooke book. People are like, oh, Sam Cooke, I'm going to check him out. It's like, this is better than you send me. This is the thing. Like, that's cool. And I like that. So I'm coming at it from a different place than other people are coming at it from because they are a journalist or something like that. So like one woman, for instance, you'll find this interesting. She worked with Dexter Gordon in the 1970s. She was like his right-hand person. She wrote me at the website and she said, all the years, everything I've read about this film, it gets it wrong. You're the only only person who's ever gone it right. And it's like, you, journalist or critic or whatever you are, it's like, well, I'm not those things. That's part of the reason why I was able to get something which she termed as right. And she was like the one like doing the bookings for him and like managing his finances. So take that for what it's worth, listeners.
We're talking with Colin Fleming. This brings up a question to me. When you're watching a film, a work of fiction, do you sometimes see a character in that film and think how you would have taken them on a different journey if you had been the writer?
I don't really anymore. I would have, like 20 years ago, in the same way that I could listen to things or read things or watch things that were easier for me to identify with. But my journey in who I've become is just so different from all of that now. And I think what jazzes me is that idea, to take it back to Dexter Gordon, of what I create and always challenging myself to position people so they can see the answers to the mysteries behind life. That's what you're trying to do. You're trying to give them the best possible seat in that particular theater, if you will, that particular house. So I don't really think that way. I will see, like, okay, this work is flawed, and these are the reasons. Like, for instance, I recently watched all of Breaking Bad, and I'd never seen it before until, like, last month. And I thought, okay, the most interesting characters in this show are Hank the detective, Maria's wife, Jesse, and the lawyer. And the main character is cartoonish and predictable. I always know what he's going to do. It's going to be like more outlandish than the time before. And I thought, that's a real flaw for something to have, because you're sort of tethered to this main character and you want to be surprised by the main protagonist. So I think that way, not like, what would I do if I took Walt? I would have him cook all day and make like blue or meth. I don't think like that.
Well, you mentioned this on the blog too. You write very quickly. You've talked about that, and you don't go about the process that some writers do of necessarily having a first draft, because so much of this is worked out in your head before you even sit down. But every once in a while,
not necessarily.
Well, but I'll no. Okay. Well, correct me then.
Well, it can be. Like, I haven't written it yet, but when I was running Stairs on Saturday, I wrote an entire Buster Keaton thing in my head. But, like, a lot of times when I write a story, I'll just sit down and I'll make up on the spot, because I think what people don't know is that I said somewhere recently, it might have been during that Sam Cooke webinar, when we're talking, we're writing. And when we're writing, we're editing. I'm saying something to you right now, and there are, like, 17 words out in front that I can already see, and I'm changing them. Do you see what I mean? Before I get there, because I want to hit a particular point of emphasis or something like that. So those words never make it to the page, but they're all being written in the moment, in this very moment. So it's like we've talked about, on the outside of you, time always wins. Time is going to do what it does. It's unstoppable. Time and tide waits for no man. But inside of you, you hold you're the dominant one, potentially over time. You can write seven things at the same time. So what does that mean? If you just extrapolate that out, that like fraction of a second, that can be an entire sort of protracted writing process that just got shrunk down because it was inside of you. So it's all these different things. It's being open to all of these different things. I don't care where I get it from. Sometimes characters have a story to tell me and they tell them to me very quickly. Other times they're like, okay, just hang out a bit. We'll get to this. We'll get through it. So I think that's one of the things for the real artist, though, that you're just open to it all. And when you're open to it all, you change in these different ways. So, yeah, it can be all worked out in my head. But when I say it's all like all worked out in my head, sometimes what that means is at the bottom of the stairs, I get an idea. And at the top of the stairs, I have the entire Buster Keaton thing. But today I wrote like this 2,000-word piece on the Rolling Stones Tumbling Dice. And I had to go fast today because I had a lot to fit in. And so I just happened to notice that took an hour. So, I mean, someone else would have strung that out and it was sucked for 8 months.
But if you go back and revisit something, what causes you to take a second look and decide that you want to go in a slightly different direction?
Oh, there can be a number of things. It can be like, for instance, as I've been doing this, I finished it now, this book of all female short stories called There Is No Doubt, Storied Humanists. Now, some of those I had gone over like pretty hard in the summer for this sort of like fool's errand that the New Yorker was leading me on. And they were leading me on that because they wanted to make it sound like they were considering my fiction. And I knew they weren't, but they were trying to make like this problem go away, the problem being me, right, by lying to me. So I went through like those five stories pretty hard. And when I go through something pretty hard, I'll often find that what I change would be something that no one else would even notice. It'll be like a word. It'll be like a paragraph. I break into multiple paragraphs. I went through Fiddy again recently. But I always like to just come back and make sure, and I'm ruthless when I go through it. But normally what happens is like there's not a lot for me to do. Now, I might view it as a lot for me to do, but like I said, someone else could read it. And just because my process is so, it's so compact. It's like when we talked a few weeks ago about analogs from Bracket, and I told you that was from 20 years ago. Mm. And so that, I don't feel like I write anything better now, but the process has changed so much because I just keep getting better. I do this every day. I mean, today I finished two short stories. I worked another short story. I wrote a feature. I put up four blogs. I wrote a fifth blog before I hopped in the air with you. I did an interview with someone about the Beatles over at the Grammys website. And it's just like, go, go, go. And I ran 5,000 stairs and wrote some more there. So it's constant. The river of creation, Kimball.
All right, let's talk about this wonderful Murder from the Bridge, Cape Cod Radio Mystery Theater. You've sent me a few of these. I really enjoy them. They do a nice job, and they set the tone so well. Now, you lived on the Cape. I've never lived there, but I've been there a number of times, and they do such a good job of evoking that foggy night on the Cape feel.
Oh, I love, don't you love it? They start that way. It's a foggy night on old Cape Cod. And it's just, once you say that, I mean, I'm biased. I'm in. Like, I'm so in at that point. Like, you could just, like, roll out Romper Room after that point with a Cape setting, and I will dig it. But these are, I don't want to sound condescending, but they're surprisingly good.
Yeah.
And when I first started listening to these, I liked the ones that were kind of general, and they didn't feature this reoccurring character who you would have heard out of the three we've talked about. This is the first one he's in. And he's in a bunch of them, and his name is kind of funny. It's like this ex, like, sort of hyenas cop, retired Captain Waverly Underhill. It sounds ridiculous, doesn't it? But then when you listen to these with him, which is the ones I actually prefer now, like, it's like, yeah, this guy is totally Waverly Underhill. Like, it fits. So the thing that I think is cool about these is this one's a good example. It reminds me a little bit of Quiet Please, because Willis Cooper with Quiet Please, he had like all these different jobs. And he would make, like, his experiences part of the story that Ernest Chappell would voice. So you think about the thing on the Forble board. You learn a lot about digging for oil, like an awful lot, and it's threaded into the story. You learn an awful lot about bridges in this story, and currents, and what happens, like how you could survive jumping off a bridge, how you wouldn't survive jumping off a bridge. And those details stack, and they pull us in. Now, like, Captain Waverly Underhill is totally, he's retired, so he's like gone totally rogue, where he picks up like this murder suspect and he drives them across the bridge, which is the Sagamore Bridge, I think, and he sort of gets him to, he baits him into sort of like a confession, and he's just out there doing this rogue police work, driving the guy to his car. I love where it's parked too. You get that? Parked at the Friendlies on the other side.
Yes.
I mean, I love a good Friendlies reference, and then it like made me want to be able to go to a Friendlies. So I'm like looking up to see if they even exist anymore. But have you been to the Cape? You've been across like at least one of those two bridges.
Oh, both the Sagamore and the Bourne, yeah.
They're just so evocative, right? These structures rising high above, and I think the story does a great job of talking about that architecture. And like when I was a kid, and I'd go across them at night, It was like a major experience. It was like seeing the Gothic, the architecture like in Manhattan on like the Upper West Side. It was just like this dominant sort of physical structure in front of you that was conveying you to and fro this magical sort of like wondrous place. And the stuff about jumping off the bridge and like what will kill you and what won't kill you is, I found it fascinating.
Yeah, they're very well done. Cape Cod Radio Mystery Theater. Check out Murder from the Bridge. Finally, we go back 40 years to the 1982 Red Sox. team that won 89 games that year. It was a pretty good team with some forgotten guys on that squad. Glenn Hoffman playing shortstop for them. Reed Nichols, the aging Tony Perez at the end of the line. What a fun team, though.
I knew this old guy. I think it was like someone we would visit like on vacation up in like the North Conway area of New Hampshire, like Lake Winnipesaukee and all that, when you're going up there for like Santa's Village. This guy, he was always adamant. It's like, they need to play Reed Nichols more. And I remember thinking, like, huh, this guy's big on Reed Nichols. So Reed Nichols has always stuck in my head since then. Like, he was this superstar, if only they had managed him better. And whenever I go to his page in Baseball Reference, I think, you were no superstar waiting to be Reed Nichols. It was such a cool team. It was like when I was first getting into baseball. So like all these guys, I wonder if that happens now. But they became like these people that have just, they're just pressed into my memory. Like Glenn Hoffman. I think Glenn Hoffman played like 150 something games that year. And Remy was on that team. And what's interesting about the 1982 Red Sox is so many of those teams from back then, like the 1985 Yankees, imagine how it would look if there was a wild card. Because some of these teams would have won. 82, like who wins? The Cardinals, they beat the Brewers. I don't know. Like the Red Sox could have been there. But one thing I will say about the Red Sox that I wasn't aware of at the time is that they sure like to take their time allowing good ball players to be full-time major leaguers. Did you notice that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Boggs at... Boggs hit 349. They only played him in 104 games that year, and he was already 24 years old.
Yeah, there's he hits like what, 361 in 83? But he's 25. So when I was collecting baseball cards, it was sort of trying to handicap who was going to make the Hall of Fame. And Beckett Baseball Card Monthly would be like, Boggs got started too late to reach 3,000. Now he did, but they didn't help him. But look at like other people. Like, you can see the 1986 team on that 82 team. You see Oil Can Boyd. You see Marty Barrett, like barely, but they're there. Bruce Hurst and like Mark Clear. And I like Mark Clear because I remember reading in the yearbook that year that he had a slurve. I'm thinking, like, what the hell is a slurve? Is that even a thing? It sounded like some 1950s sci-fi pitch that an alien would have taught you. Like, if the blob threw a pitch, it would have been the slurve. So I was into that. And it was kind of like a modified curveball. It actually wasn't very exciting. And they've gotten rid of the name because it sounds so ridiculous. But your man, Mr. Yastrzemski, he's whatever he was, like 42.
42.
He was pretty good that year.
Yes, he was. And I'm looking at that bullpen. This is when men were men in the bullpen. Bob Stanley, 168 innings, all in relief. Mark Clear, 105 innings. 38-year-old Tom Bergmeier, 102 innings of relief and went 7-0 with a 2.29 ERA.
Yeah, they weren't a bad team at all. And I mean, Garrett Whitlaw is going to end up playing like what? Pitching, I don't know, 70 innings this year? Like not even. I look at that and it does make me, it's not nostalgic, it makes me frustrated about now. And you had Ralph Houk, who just sounds like he was probably a horrible person to be around. It was miserable and sort of like was like he looked by that point. And I know Remy used to go on about his bad experiences with him, but you had the tease that was Dave Stapleton. Because remember Dave Stapleton, like at first place, he got like rookie of the year votes, I think.
Oh, yeah.
He was like fifth or something like that. He never came close to what he did in 1982. Don't you always wonder about guys who just come out and they have their best ever year by far in their rookie year? And I don't mean like Fred Lynn. And he didn't even. He was better in 79. But just the guys who do that, it's Matt Noakes. It's just strange to me that there it is, like Ron Kittle, right? But like,
yeah.
Then he's okay the second year. And then he's like terrible. He's not like Jackie Bradley Jr. terrible, but he's pretty terrible.
They've also got, I think he was a third string catcher that year. And I believe it's the only year he played, Roger LaFrancois, who went 4-for-10. And then never made the majors again. And so he's got a career batting average in Major League Baseball of 400.
Doesn't Gedman show up on that team too?
Oh, yeah. Gedman played 92 games that year.
So the regular catcher then was Gary Allenson.
Muggsy, yes.
But it's weird when you look at things like that, though, when you do see the innings pitched out of the bullpen and things of that nature. And your man, Dwight Evans, it's one of sort of the cornerstone years for him, for his Hall of Fame case, don't you think? Because Rice is there doing his thing, and he has the huge year in 83, and not far removed from the big 70s years. Dwight Evans is far and away the best hitter on that team, though. Mm. You look at his OPS and that type of thing. Well, Evans was awesome in 81. And I wonder, with Evans, because you see these guys who have these career years and strike-shortened seasons, see it in hockey, too, right? So I wonder if, that year in that limited sample size where you get hot and then things can't go that badly for you because the season comes to an end, water maybe doesn't find its own level. I wonder if that gave him the confidence to sort of power into future seasons like it did, because he was awesome in 81. He was a borderline MVP.
Yeah, didn't he lead the league in home runs, I think, that year with 22?
Yeah, it was the four-person tie. Because remember that baseball card, the league leader?
Yes.
And the home run one is here are our four little heads. It's almost some grim thing from the Indian Ocean and in the Melville tale type of thing. And Bobby Gritch was one of those.
Oh, people. Yes. Wow.
And there was Evans. And that's the first time I remember thinking, I was really young, thinking this guy can hit too. Because before then, he was just Mr. Right Field. And so it was, I don't know, if people at the time expected him to duplicate that, but he showed in 1982 that was no fluke. And it just, this was fun. But you also knew at the same time during that season, they were out of it. And you didn't expect them to contend. Now, this team will be very lucky to get to 89 wins. And that'll put them at borderline wild card team. And then who knows? You have a shot. I wish some of those other teams from back then could have had a shot and done something, made some noise in the playoffs.
I was trying to remember. Yeah, it was George Bamberger, the manager of the Milwaukee Brewers that year that won it all in the American League.
No, it was Harvey Keene.
Oh, Harvey Keene, okay.
Because remember that.
Oh, Harvey's Wallbangers, right? Yes.
And they were fun. They had Paul Molitor and they had Robin Yount. He was the MVP. And it's funny, if people don't know this name, look him up. Gorman Thomas. He was this big slugger, burly, drooling tobacco juice on himself. This is how cool the 80s were. He was a center fielder. He shouldn't be a softball, men's league, beer league center fielder. He's I'll patrol center field. Don't worry about it, Milwaukee.
Love it. Well, go back and take a look at that 82 Red Sox team, and it'll bring back some pleasant memories for you. Colin Fleming, who joins us every Tuesday here on Downtown. Colin, thank you much, my friend. We'll do it again next week.
Yeah, it sounds good.